Hey there, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast, Super Bowl edition. I'm John St. Augustine, glad to have you joining me from anywhere and everywhere. Let's get to it. Dun, dun. Glad to have you joining me. As I said, it is Super Bowl Sunday coming up. You're hearing this show on a Friday, and there's a couple reasons for that. First and foremost, you're going to be hearing a conversation a little bit later in this podcast, not too much later, with my good and great friend, the Hall of Fame celebrated Green Bay Packer guard, Jerry Kramer, who played for the Lombardi Packers for 10 years, was also in Super Bowl I and Super Bowl II. So if you want to talk to somebody about the Super Bowl, he's the guy that you talk to. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, this show is two shows in one. Started a new show on WCRW 1190 AM in Washington, D.C. called The Dow of Music. And I'm starting to work guests in on this musical show that I do. And some of my best traveling stories with Jerry Kramer has to do with us singing and not real well to all kind of songs. And it occurred to me that I could maybe kind of do a mashup of the two. So you're hearing on this podcast a music-less episode. But on Sunday, for the Dow of Music, which will air in Washington, D.C., and at ports of call around the world via the internet thing, there's a story in there about Jerry and Ray Charles, which is pretty cool, and some Ray Charles music as well. So if you're so inclined on Sunday morning at 10 o'clock Central Time, you can go to newworldradio.com and click Listen Live, and you will catch my show. That's at 10 a.m. on Sunday mornings. Just go to newworldradio.com, click Listen Live, and there you'll find me. I have a page there and everything, and you'll be able to hear it anywhere through the internet unless you're living in Washington, D.C., and tune it in at 1190 a.m. But enough of that. This conversation I had with Jerry, in full disclosure and disclaimer, number one is I apologize for the quality of the recording. This was done very old school. On Jerry's end, there's not a lot of technology going on, and rightfully so. He's probably smarter than I am in that regard. So I had to use what's called a Zoom machine. It's this tiny little robot, basically, that I've used for years to record conversations, but it is not the quality of what I use now, that's for sure. So I cleaned it up the best that I can. There are some cracks and crunkles and all kind of static here and there and stuff like that, mostly on my end, which I found interesting. Jerry's got this booming voice that's like a mixture, like if you took gravel and put it in a bucket and poured whiskey over it and then honey and shake it all around and then blow some smoke on top of it, it's kind of like that voice. So I apologize for the quality, but the quantity and the content is just, to me, priceless. It is a retrospective on the Super Bowl, this grand event that when Jerry first played in the first one in 1967 it was supposed to be called the AFL-NFL or the NFL-AFL championship game. And it was Lamar Hunt, who was the owner of the Kansas City Chiefs, said, we got to need to call it the Super Bowl. And the name stuck. Interesting how different things have gone in the last 56 years with the Super Bowl. You'll hear Jerry talk about Super Bowl I and Super Bowl II. I don't think it was really till Super Bowl III, though, that things cracked open, because that's when Joe Namath made a guarantee that his New York Jets were going to beat the Baltimore Colts, headed up by Johnny Unitas, he with the greatest flat-top haircut on the planet. So since that time, it has grown and grown and grown. Of course, it's become this worldwide phenomenon. And just a couple of little trivia tidbits before we get into the conversation with Jerry. The Rams and the Bengals are playing this Sunday in Super Bowl 56. But if you go back to Super Bowl I, there were no cheerleaders for either team, really. So because they played in the L.A. Coliseum, they got the Los Angeles Ramettes, who were majorettes that had performed at all the Ram home games and entertained during pregame festivities and after each quarter. They got them to do that. So here we are 56 years later. Now the Rams have played in other Super Bowls, but here we are. They're not really, I mean, they're in L.A., but they're not. Call it what it is. They're not in the Coliseum, let's put it that way. But the L.A. Ramettes were the official cheerleaders of Super Bowl I, like it or not. The University of Arizona band created a physical outline of the continental United States at the center of the field, with the famed Anaheim High School drill team placing banners at each team's geographical location. So that was a big selling point. And the halftime show, which now has become stratospheric and a bunch of other metaphors. I mean, I don't even know what to say about some of them. Most of them are like, okay, whatever. But back then, the number one man with the band was the trumpeter Al Hurt. He played at halftime, as well as the University of Arizona and Grambling State University, 300 pigeons and 10,000 balloons and a flying demonstration by the hydrogen peroxide propelled Bell Rocket Airman flying around. You may have seen that video over the years, flying around the Coliseum. That was the halftime show. And boy, we've come a long way from that. I don't hold much with the halftime stuff. Like I said, I mean, you know, it's become, I got to be careful here because I love football and I played a lot of football, high school, college, semi-pro, and all that goes with the game. And the last in-person game I went to was the Rams and the Bears about 4 years ago, and I vowed I'd never go back again. And it wasn't about the game. It was all the breads and circuses around it that I found distracting and strange and what. And it wasn't about the game as much as it was about entertainment. And to me, it kind of lost. But it is what it is, and it ain't what it ain't, as they say. I'm going to cue up this conversation with Jerry again. My apologies for the quality. I think there's some great things that he's got to share. He's a great friend and a great guy and really walking history of the NFL, especially Super Bowl I and II. I'll come back on the other side of the conversation with just a few more thoughts. As promised, I couldn't think of anybody better to talk about Super Bowls, especially the first one and the second one, and what it's like for the pomp and circumstance all around all that stuff, than my friend Jerry Kramer, who joins me from Boise, Idaho. Jerry, thanks so much for doing the show.
Great to be with you, Johnny.
So one of the things that's vivid in my mind, outside of the adventures you and I've had, there was one that comes to mind, picking you up in Milwaukee, and we had to go to some hotel to pick up a jacket that you had left there a few months earlier, and it just happened to have a bar attached to it. Go figure. And we spent a little bit of time in the bar. Once people in Milwaukee found out that Jerry Kramer was there, it was kind of like the Beatles showed up on Ed Sullivan. I was thinking about Instant Replay came to be. Wasn't it the deal that Dick Schaap, the great sports writer, was doing going to do a story on Jimmy Taylor, who was your roommate at the time, and he walked past, and there you were reading poetry, and Jimmy was falling asleep. Isn't that how it happened?
That's pretty much the way it was, yeah. I did like to share certain poems with certain people, and Dick did do that, and that was an actual event. And Jimmy was not a poetry guy, so I didn't bother him very much.
I can't imagine there were a lot of poetry guys in the NFL at that time.
I think I might have been the only one, John. Yeah. I don't know, but there was a lot of those guys are pretty sensitive and pretty fundamentally sound, and don't underrate them.
There you go. Well, I, like millions of young men and women, read Instant Replay. It was a seminal, life-changing read for so many people. And you look back on it all these years later, and who knew that you'd be going, you know, that were the Ice Bowl, and then headed to the Super Bowl I, and then Super Bowl II. That book was like the precursor to so many great sports books.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me. Dick came up with the idea, and he says, we'd been acquainted with each other for several years, so we knew each other pretty well, and he called one time, he said, I want you to do a book. I said, what do you mean, do a book? He said, write a book. I said, what do I know about writing a book? He said, well, you'll get a tape recorder and talk into it on a daily basis, and I'll edit it, and we'll make it into a book. I said, who gets final say? He said, you do. Okay, let's talk. So I immediately go to practice after that, and we have a two-a-day drills in about 100-degree weather, and Lombardi is trying to kill us or get as close to killing us as possible without actually killing us. It just exhausts us. So I had talked to myself in the mirror about long multi-syllable words that I might use as a author. I'd had to get some real flowery language and, you know, as authors would. And after that practice, I came back to my room and I looked in the mirror again. I said, "Hey, fool, it is what it is. And you is what you is. And you just tell it exactly as you see it and exactly as you believe it to be. And if nobody likes it, that's all right. I'm just going to try to be dead honest with myself and my teammates." And so that's the thought that prevailed once we come through there. And Dick would edit things from time to time. There are certain areas he didn't want to go into. And I said, "Okay, we'll pass on that." But it was a stunning success. I hoped, you know, that we'd sell a few thousand books or something like that. And maybe I'd do a few interviews and, you know, nothing special. But I did a wonderful interview with Flip Wilson at Chicago. Uh-huh. Just had a great time. We did a show there, and then I got to do the Tonight Show, and then I got to do just all kinds of things that were not in a lineman's normal course of event.
What a journey it's been, you know, and here we are on Super Bowl Sunday, 56 years later, after that kickoff back on January 15th, 1967. And we've had numerous conversations, you and I, over the years about that first Super Bowl and the second one. But I remember some story about, you know, showing up at the Coliseum and there were people that were waiting for tickets and you had some extra ones. They were like $5 a piece or something. And you just gave tickets away to some kid standing outside on the street. Is that right?
No, they were $10 a piece, John. I saw something today that the tickets were going for $10,000 for the Super Bowl. But, you know, Super Bowl I was a little bit of an unknown thing. And I remember the press corps being very excited, and the coaches, about the number of press that was at the game. There were two buses. Jerry, they had to take two buses to get all the press over here.
Two buses.
So, and Coach Lombardi had two networks broadcasting, and I think ABC and CBS. But it was a little bit different. And I've got some nephews in the area there that wanted to go to the game. So I got five tickets at $10 a piece, and I'm in the locker room, and I go down by the gate where they're supposed to meet me, and I go back and forth a couple of times, and finally, you know, it's half hour past the meeting time, and I'm getting a little tight about our schedule and the game, and I go down to the gate one last time, and there are four or five kids playing over by the outside gate. I go, "You guys want to go to the game?" "Yeah." "Well, come on." So I gave them to the kids, and there were about 10,000 empty seats at the game, Johnny. But then the Coliseum, and of course, there was some high seats and some bad seats there, but not many. Yeah. But there were about 10,000 empty seats, so it was a kind of a new experiment.
Yeah, there was a lot on the line at that first Super Bowl. You had the old guard, the NFC, against the upstart AFC, Kansas City, coached by Hank Stram, you know, and it was really bragging rights in a lot of ways. Was that the message Lombardi kind of passed along to you guys?
Well, you know, we really didn't know them. We had never known anyone that played against them. We'd never seen a film of them. We just didn't know anything about them. We were watching film. We did have film. Excuse me. That we were watching films of Kansas City one night, and two of their safeties ran into each other, and knocked each other down. And Max McGee was saying, run that back. I want to see that again. And they ran it back, and Max goes, "Na na 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 na."
He's
taking Mary Tunes and Looney Melodies, right?
Oh,
Looney Tunes and Mary Melodies. So we play the first half, and Buck Buchanan is 6'8", 285. Bobby Bell is one of the great linebackers that ever played, and they're a much better football team than we anticipated. So we got a little chewing at halftime and came out of the locker room ready to go to work, and we did. We got pretty serious about it second half and scored two or three touches.
Yeah, you guys won that first game 35-10, and then the next year, January 14th of 1968, you're down in the Orange Bowl in Miami to take on the Oakland Raiders, who they were the bad boys and still, I think, try to be the bad boys of the NFL. What was that like for you?
It was, again, it was a great day, a much better game than we anticipated. We didn't anticipate them being that strong. But the big thing at that game was Coach Lombardi on Thursday, prior to the game. We were having a team meeting, and he's going over the schedule and what we're supposed to be and the time and the place and all the information there. And he's up on the stage in front of us. We're at a lower level. And so he starts to walk away, and he gets about 12, 15 steps from the podium, and he turns around and says, and this may be our last time together. Mm. And then walked off the stage. And I looked at Fuzz, and Fuzz looked at me, and I go, you suppose? And I said, well, that's what he said. And so we spent halftime of the second Super Bowl. I addressed the team, and I said, hey, guys, there's a good chance that this will be Coach's last game in Green Bay. So let's go out there and win the second half for the coach. And Willie, you and Bob are to carry him off the field. He needs to go off the field on the shoulders of his men. If that works out for you, I think it'd be a great idea. So as the game ended, Coach started walking out on the field, and I don't know where Bob and Willie were, but they weren't there. So Forrest was beside me, Forrest Gregg. He said, Jerry, let's grab him. So we ran out on the field and hoisted him up on our shoulders and carried him off the field and gave him the salute and the respect that we felt was appropriate.
That Sports Illustrated cover with that image, you talked about you and Forrest carrying him off, and there's Coach looking at you, is one of the most iconic, I think it's one of the top 10 Sports Illustrated covers of all time. You know, 56 years go by, and I know that you've been to many Super Bowls, and, you know, listen, your career on the field is well documented. The things that you've done off the field for helping people and you know, boys and girls clubs, and it is endless. You've really, in so many ways, more than just about anybody, I think, in football, and you know quite a few guys have used what you were given. You know, you come out of nowhere, Sandpoint, Idaho, didn't know where Green Bay was. The first year you were there was the worst in the team's history, and Lombardi shows up, and next thing you know, within a decade, you're America's team to some greater or lesser degree. When you look back on the Super Bowl experiences now compared to what's going on, you know, with the game today, it's like a twilight zone.
Yeah, Johnny, let me tell you one story about that 57 team. The year before Coach Lombardi arrived, we ended up the season as 1-10-1, worst record in the history of the franchise. And Baltimore, with Johnny Unitas and the great teams they had there, beat us 56-0. They had a white horse, a colt, that ran around the field every time they scored. Damn near killed him that day. 56 points, right? So then Coach Vincent Thomas Lombardi arrived, and he started explaining preparation. Now, Johnny, there's a lot of ways to look at a big defensive tackle. You look at his feet, you look at his stance, you look at his hand, you look at his moves, you study him. And if you're lucky, Leo Nomolini was one of the great defensive tackles in the game at that time, and first-term Hall of Famer, right? And he had his right foot back when he was going inside, and he had his feet parallel when he was going outside. Mm. Well, that made a dramatic difference in my ability to block him and to anticipate which way he was going. So preparation, commitment, consistency, discipline, pride, character, so many things that he believed in, he taught us, and we began to believe in.
I remember reading in Instant Replay, and this helped me in my career in high school and college later, believe it or not. You talk about the position of the feet of a defensive tackle. So I played linebacker, and I could watch the fingers of the offensive lineman. And if there was a lot of pressure on their fingers, they were moving forward for a run block. And if there was no pressure on their hand, they were probably doing a pass block. And that's something I picked up reading Instant Replay. And these are even the greats of the game would tip things off.
Well, that's a classic example of reading the defense and studying and understanding, getting to know, and especially after, you know, a guy like Alex Karras was a great defensive tackle too, but we played him twice a year for 10 years, and so I got to know him awfully well, and a lot better than I really wanted to at times, because he was a tiger. He was a mess. He was a professional wrestler, as was Leo Nomolini. Yeah. And so both of them had great control of the body and their great upper body strength.
Tell me the story about the Super Bowl II ring. What an unbelievable event that was. The plane, was that the one that got lost on the plane, or was it Super Bowl I?
No. Well, it was Super Bowl I. Oh. I went to the restroom and washed my hands, and the ring came off, and I set it on the sink, and went back and sat down. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, damn, I left my ring in the restroom. So I jumped up out of my seat and went back to the restroom, and of course it's gone. And I'm up and down the aisle looking for somebody. I don't know if it's grandma with her purse and her handkerchief, or right fingered Louie, or who it might be, but I'm up and down the aisle, and I of course don't see anything or find anything. And about 20 years later, it shows up in a pawn shop in Chicago, and the guy calls me and he said, Jerry, I think I have your ring. And I said, I immediately bristled up, and I said, well, that's really important to me, and it's very big part of my life. And you'd better relax. I'm going to give it back to you. I just want to return it and let you make sure it's yours. But he returned it to me at no cost. And so it was, ended up, and I had two rings because I had a new one made. And I don't, now I wear my Hall of Fame ring now, John. That's above all. So,
always an interesting adventure. I've been very fortunate to be in a lot of orbits from a lot of incredible people, and your life's like a movie. And there was a movie done. I was very honored to play a small role, getting some of the Bears footage in there. But finally, a documentary came out this past year on. You can if you will. What was that like for you to be part of that process after so long?
Well, it was flattering, John. It was really a great idea, and I was able to bring my family into it. My children, my nieces and nephews, cousins, just a tremendous number of family members. And then there were maybe, golly, a dozen NFL players, starting with Aaron Rodgers and Brett Favre and Franco Harris and just Bob Lilly and on and on and on, you know, just a tremendous number of testimonials, like 12 or 15 guys. So that was very flattering to have them say nice things about me and praise my play and say I deserve to be there and everything. And it really was a emotional kind of thing at this point, right? Mm-hmm. It was long since I've been on the field, and to read nice things about my time and my play and my game is always very welcome at this particular point in time. So that was a nice piece, and it turned out really nice, and we've had a lot of praise for it. And the Packers were selling it at the Packer Pro Shop, and I gave my Super Bowl induction, or my Pro Hall of Fame induction speech, and I based it on a incident as a sophomore in high school. I was a big kid. I was clumsy as a goat. I had fat fingers and big feet, and I'm a sophomore. And my line coach is an older man, and he's been around a lot, and he was pretty wise. And he comes over to me one day I'm feeling a little bit down. I've been having difficulties. And he grabs my hand and looks at it and said, son, you got big hands and you got big feet. And you're going to grow into them one of these days. And you're going to be a great football player. And then he starts to walk away, and he gets four or five steps away, and he turns around and looks at me, and he said, you can, if you will. And I said, can what? If I will, what? What do you mean? Finish the sentence. And he just smiled at me and walked away. So that was a thing that stuck in my mind, and every time I wanted to quit, I said, well, you can quit if you want to, or you can go ahead and compete if you want to. It's up to you. You can if you will. And so I used that in my speech, talking about life and decisions and things like that. And that was from my high my sophomore year in high school, wow. Johnny.
Wow. You know, as I mentioned, I had an opportunity to work on the project a little bit. It was already down the line before I got to see it and myself, and I sent it over to Bill Curtis to look at it. And this is all behind-the-scenes stuff. And I worked with Brian McCaskey at the Bears to find 8 seconds of footage from 1967 against the Bears, and it took 3 months for that to happen. And, you know, it was all part of that. It was all part of the puzzle. But watching it on my production computer is one thing, because I'm looking at it with a production eye and how it all folds together. But I've been to two of the premieres, one in Green Bay, one in Milwaukee, and I told you afterwards, there was an unintended, I think, spiritual aspect to this documentary. And what I mean by that is both times I was there and I watched from the back row and watched people and watched you and people watching you and all that kind of stuff, it's more than football. I mean, the one thing I've appreciated most about our relationship and friendship over the years is you're very dimensional. You're not a one-dimensional guy that's all about three-point stance and that's it. And I think that came through in the documentary. And sometimes I think even people that are attending the games or watching the games or getting caught up like today, it's the Rams and the Bengals are going to go at it. There's more to it than just football. And I can't quite put my finger on it. Have you ever thought about how much beyond the game this really goes for people?
Well, Johnny, I've tried to speak about the game and the coach and the lessons, especially the younger folks, to give them something to hang on to and believe in themselves, and fairly, squarely, decently, by the rules. You don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all the time, every time. And those kind of things came from Coach Lombardi virtually every day or every week. And we were such a ragtag bunch of guys the year before he arrived at 1-10-1. And then the second year after he was there, we went to the championship game. We went to Philly in 1960, and we got beat. And he got in the locker room immediately after the game, and he stands on a trunk full of parkas and whatnot, and he goes, all right, bring it up, bring it up. This year, we played in the championship, and we'll never lose another one. Next year, we're going to be in the championship. And so we believed in him. And your beliefs are such a powerful part of what your life is, what your expectations are, what you're willing to take a shot at. And if you believe in yourself and believe in your team, you can. You can. You can. If you will.
There's not a lot of guys left from those first 2 years on either side of the ball, whether it's the Packers or the Raiders or the Chiefs, getting few and far between. And so, your perspective on this is getting pretty singular. So when you watch the Super Bowl now, the pomp, the circumstance, I remember reading somewhere like halftime at one of the Super Bowls was the USC marching band, and the next year might have been Al Hurt, the trumpet player. You know, I mean, now millions are spent, billions are generated on this thing. When you sit and watch the game, at home, you know, on the couch with maybe some sort of a libation in hand, and you watch the Rams and the Bengals go at it 56 years later. None of these guys were born, you know, when you were playing in it. What do you think about?
I think about my guys a lot. I think about Bart and Paul and Jimmy and Fuzzy and Forrest and Ron, Gilly, Skeester, all the guys, just all of them, with such a wonderful brotherhood. Willie Davis and I roomed together for the last year, my last year in Green Bay, and he's like a brother to me, and just so much pride amongst ourselves, and you didn't want to let the team down, Johnny. You played for Coach Lombardi, but you also played for your teammates, the guys around you, and you sacrificed your body from time to time because they needed you, and you could play with a little pain. Well, I had some big pains for a number of different years and different times, but it taught me that I could do just about anything I wanted to do, and if I felt good about being able to play at that level and support my teammates and not be a weak link in the game. So it gave me a great deal of confidence about other things in life. So I tried a half a dozen different professions, apartment building, coal mining business, oil business, health business, and it was a learning experience in each and every one of them. But those fundamentals, if they're applied to whatever you do, you will do them better, and you will do them better than the competition. So it's not about strength. It's not about speed. It's about mental intellect and belief and desire and hunger and want and fire and how much you want to pay for it. You can do it. Everybody can do it. It's our professions are not just for a thin layer of humanity across the top. It's for the whole population, and especially those who want it, who are willing to pay a price for it. So that was a wonderful education for me. It made me believe in myself and believe in my mind and believe in things I could do or couldn't do. So it was a incredible experience, and I've just been, it's like I get pinched every once in a while because I can't believe it. I have had such a wonderful ride, Johnny, with so many great folks along the way, and I'm just very happy with the life I've had to lead and the time I've been able to spend on football.
You know, it gets to the point where some of this stuff gets so saturated, meaning, you know, you and I go back probably 32, 33 years now, and I've been hearing this, you don't do things right once in a while, you do them all the time forever. And it came down such a bad, I was, two, 3 years ago, it was really hot out. It had to be 80, 85, 90. And I'm cutting the grass and doing stuff, and I look up, and there's one of the big bushes next to the alley needs to be trimmed. And I'm like, you know what? It's too hot. I'm not going to do that. And what do I hear in my head? You don't do things right once in a while. It's the pull out the ladder, get the hedge trimmer. It's infectious.
It is. It really is. You make a deal with yourself, and you got to stick to it. You just got to believe in it and live it.
One of the things that, as we get ready to wrap this up, I first of all appreciate your time. I have enjoyed our antics for three decades, and some of it I've written about in books. Jack Canfield, who's one half of the Chicken Soup for the Soul team that sold, I don't know, 150 bajillion copies of those books, came to me once when I was at Harpo doing Oprah Radio, and he said, listen, I'm doing this new book called You've Got to Read This Book, and I'm having 15 authors contribute to it. So people, you know, see what it is that moves you. And of all the books that I could have picked of that I've read that have moved me, I had to pick Instant Replay. And of course, I got a chance to retell some of the tales and antics and things like that. And when I think about, you know, the time we were up in Michigan together and doing the Lessons from Lombardi event, which was a big kick, and it was a chance to watch that connection again. You know, you had been on the football field for decades, but here are all these people, full house, wanting to hear the Lessons of Lombardi. And at the end of that talk, you quoted the Invictus poem, which I just found fascinating. I've heard it my whole life, but never quite the way that you do. Would you mind plying us with that one more time?
Out of the night that covers me, dark as a pit from pole to pole, I thank the Lord above for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. And under the bludgeonings of fate, my head is bloody, but unbowed. In this pale of gloom and tears, looms but the shadow of the glade. And yet the passing of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. Matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate, and I am the captain of my soul.
Jerry, on that note, thanks so much for taking the time today. Any predictions on the Super Bowl? Who's going to come out on top, Rams or Bengals?
I would probably put my money on the Rams.
I'm right with you on that. I'll be having a virtual 101 proof at the same time you will, so we'll stay connected that way.
Okay. Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks, Jerry.
Great to be with you.
Man, that Invictus thing gets me every single time. We were at, as I mentioned in the clip, with Jerry in Canton in 2018 when he was inducted to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And to sit in the audience with thousands of people during this induction ceremony, Brian Urlacher was there. It was great, too. Before he had hair, I think it was. Well, he had hair. Yeah, 2018, he had hair. This is when he's doing the hair thing. But to hear Jerry do Invictus to this crowd, and you could hear a pin drop, was really quite a thing. At 86, he is still moving forward. I have a lot of respect for that man. And let me tell you and share with you one of our adventures. And I think Super Bowl stuff aside, football stuff aside, it's all about character on and off the field. And I witnessed things many, many times over with Jerry. We're at dinner, people come up to him. We were out playing golf, people come up to him, whatever it was. But in particular, there's one that really sticks in my mind among many. We were playing golf in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Jerry had come to spend time with me there. We had a couple of events. We were in the Super Bowl of walleye fishing by ESPN. It was just really cool. And so they set us up with, you know, the boat and the whole thing. And we went out and did okay. But he was really there to sign autographs and do stuff. And it turned out one of the head gurus at ESPN had read, like I did, Instant Replay, was a huge fan. So it brought Jerry in to do that. We also got a chance to play some golf together for a day and kind of take a break. And of course, when Kramer, you know, comes to Michigan, Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is so very close, 2-hour drive from Green Bay north, there's a lot of Packer fans there. And I was at the time, I was on the radio every day. And, you know, more people knew me than I knew them. But anyway, I got this note one day with a phone number, and it was a woman asking if there's any way possible that in his 3 or 4 days that Jerry was there, we had a packed schedule, if Mr. Kramer, number 64, could possibly visit her ailing father. And as it turns out, the house that her father lived in was, I don't know, a block or two away from the golf course that we were playing that particular Saturday. So I called the woman. I said, look, I can't make any promises. I do not like basically putting these things on him. He's got enough of that. But I'll mention it to him. And if he thinks it's, you know, something to do, then there we go. And she says, well, on the off chance that it happens, I will leave the garage door open, the outer upper, you know, the big garage door. I'll leave that open. And you could just walk into the house that way. So, okay. And, you know, I really, in all the years we've known each other, I don't like to have him sign things. We have this big event I do every year for my high school, Schurz High School, and he's always signed a helmet and stuff. If it's to help other people, that's great. But rarely do I do things just to say, here's a gift or here's a present, because he is, even at 86, he is inundated with this stuff. So I rarely do that. And even back then, to stop at somebody's house is asking a lot. You know, I just was not always comfortable doing that. So we're golfing, and it's about 3/4 of the way through the day, whatever. We're probably halfway through, or if not Lemoore, our 18 holes. And as we're driving, I say, hey, listen, I got this, you know, thing, and here's what happened. And this nanny goes, oh, okay. And didn't say any more about it. And that was it. So we finish up, and we're unloading our golf clubs into my truck. And he goes, hey, he says, so how close is this guy to the golf course? I said, oh, it's got to be 3 blocks down the road here. It can't be far. He said, what time is our dinner event? I said, well, we got 2 hours in between golf and all that, and we got to do this thing with ESPN. And he says, well, let's go see the old boy. All right. So we drive over there, and sure enough, the garage door is up, and we get out, and we come walking through the garage, and there's these short steps from the garage up into what appears to be the, you know, the living part of the house, upper level, I guess you'd say, maybe 4 or 5 steps. And I'm behind Jerry, and he's walking up the steps, and he opens the door, into the kitchen, and I'm looking under his left arm. So he opens the door, he swings open. I'm looking under his left arm into the living room, through the kitchen into the living room, and there's a guy in a chair there with, you know, an IV in and a bunch of tubes and a breathing thing. And, you know, he looks like death warmed over. And Kramer walks in the door, and he yells at the top of his lungs, "Is there any Packer fans in here?" And the guy, the guy turns his head and looks, recognizes Jerry, rises like Lazarus from the dead, basically, out of his chair with these tubes and shit hanging all over him. And he says, "Hell of a block, Kramer," alluding to the Ice Bowl in 1966. Jerry walks in and he treats the guy like a long lost brother. And of course, word spread pretty quick. And all of a sudden, people are starting to migrate to this house. And at one point, I look up and there's got to be 20, 30 people outside talking, laughing, and you know, a smaller group of about 6 or 8, 10 people around Jerry and this guy in the living room. And I'm just sitting in the corner shaking my head. That's character. He didn't have to do it. In a day and age where athletes get paid ridiculous amounts of money, I'm sure some of them do things, and I'm appreciative of that. But this is way off the charts. This is decades after the man retired. He did not have to make that stop. And yet, that being said, every time I was with him and something like this came up, whether it was through me or somebody else, we were at dinner and a guy came in. We were at a dinner one time, you know, two of us sitting at a table talking, and this guy just walks over and plops himself down. "You're Jerry Kramer, aren't you?" "Yes, sir, I am." And the guy starts talking about how he and his best friend were coaching youth football, and they decided that they were going to like go to all the football stadiums or something like that. And his friend was killed in a car accident while they were trying to go to all these stadiums. And the last place they were going to go was to Green Bay, as I recall. And the guy was visibly shaken, and Jerry puts his big paw on the guy's shoulder and starts talking to him about, you know, overcoming loss and defeat and difficulty and how honored he felt the guy was sitting there. And my jaw's just hanging open. And every time that happened, I felt like they were preordained to some greater or lesser degree, that I was just a chance to be witness to this stuff. I've seen it dozens of times, more than I can even count. And going back to the guy whose house we walked into, it was time to go at one point, and Jerry stood there and signed everybody's autographs, and then he hugged this guy. And I have this image of Kramer hugging this guy who's dying. And I thought, this has zero to do with football and everything to do with football. And that's the best mix of it, to not be so involved in the game that you forget who you are, because it's you know, they're all disposable heroes. But yet to carry on what you were given so long after the game has left you is just the most remarkable thing I'd ever seen. Here's the man, 86. I got a chance to see him a few months ago in Milwaukee. And boy, my life has, ever since I read Instant Replay as a little kid in the backseat of that car driving back from Appleton, Wisconsin on a vacation in 1968 when I read it, which was a year after it came out, I think. I have been blessed and honored to be in Kramer's orbit, that's for sure. I hope you enjoyed the show. You can, again, catch the other musical edition of this conversation I had with Jerry and a great story about him and Paul Horning and a bunch of other guys at some, like, a nightclub in Milwaukee, and ended up being on stage with Ray Charles. It's pretty cool. So with that being said, I'm going to echo Jerry's sentiments. Let's go Rams and make that work. And I hope you enjoyed the show. Be well, safe travels. Until next time, adios.